Hello and welcome back to Drinking Liberally, the podcast that combines good alcohol with some mostly friendly political banter. I'm Kevin Wilson. I'm joined by my co-host, Jeff Fenner.
How's everybody doing?
This is a very special episode of the Drinking Liberally podcast. This is our after-hours roundtable. It's going to be a pretty free-flowing episode where we just shoot the shit with our good friend Dennis Skeet over on Mic 3.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Welcome, Dennis. What are you drinking today?
Today I'm drinking rum, hailing from Barbados, my family's homeland. It's Mount Gay. Yeah, it's a nice rum. I love it.
I'm going to be pretty honest with you. We cracked into that before you got here. I didn't realize it was a family thing.
Yeah.
Now I feel uncomfortable.
And producer Yago was like, guys, no. That's Dennis's rum.
He did stand up for you.
Yeah, he told us not to touch it.
It's not Dennis's rum. It's rum for the studio.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate it.
And on our fourth mic, we actually have our producer Yogs joining us today too.
Hi, everybody.
What are you drinking there, bud?
I'm drinking American Liquor Classic, which is called Tito's, made in Austin, Texas, because I'm pro America.
Wow.
And pro Texas, I suppose.
Yes.
Okay.
Just drinking Tito's and Club.
Rousing start.
Just a Tito's and Club regular drink. Nothing crazy.
Jeff, what are you drinking?
You know, so I went back to the Andigator.
Fantastic. Yep.
Check out two episodes ago if you want to hear about this delicious beverage.
Yeah. Can't say enough good things about that beer. Yeah.
Really good.
Just to round it out, I'm actually drinking something new for our round table. It's the Metric beer from the Industrial Arts Brewing Company in Garnerville, New York. Garnerville's just south of Bear Mountain, west side of the Hudson River, so not too far from Manhattan. This is it's a German Pilsner, 4.7% alcohol by volume. Pours like a Pilsner. It's pretty clear. It's actually got a huge foamy head to it that I honestly almost overflowed onto my laptop as I was pouring it into the glass. But you know, it's pretty light. It's got a smell that reminds me of freshly cut grass, although Dennis vehemently disagrees with me on that. Pretty textbook German Pilsner. I really enjoy this. Like I said at the top, this is going to be a pretty free-flowing episode here. We don't really have a set outline. Just want to sit down and chat with some of my buds over some beers here and some liquor.
We hope to entertain you a little bit. We don't know where it's actually going to go, to be honest with everybody, and love to hear the feedback from everybody about what they think of this when it's done.
I'll say I have a question for... I'm going to pose this to Dennis first, actually. Just get into a little background here. Dennis, what got you interested in politics in general?
That's a good question. So I remember watching the debates with Bill Clinton.
Okay.
And I don't know why, but I just thought it was really interesting. And I remember like watching with my dad. I couldn't vote, but at that point I don't know what I knew about politics and the president and all that kind of stuff. I just thought it was really interesting. Everyone's like talking about these different ideas. And the funny thing is I do remember one of the main things I remember from that debate was like looking at Bill Clinton and being like, this guy seems a little shady, but that's one of the first memories of like politics and everything that I remember. And it's from whatever reason, I've always just been into it.
Just from that point on, huh? Well, that's pretty perceptive of you as a young person, seeing through the Bill Clinton shadiness at the time.
I mean, it was an honest like feeling. I mean, it's not something I'm making up. I just remember like, you know, the guy had his like his southern accent and, you know, kind of like slick talking. I was like, oh, that guy's like cool, but he's a little shady. But then I saw him on Arsenio Hall's show, like playing a saxophone and everything. And I was like, okay, this guy's cool. I like this guy.
That was the difference, right? Playing the saxophone.
So, yeah.
I got in around Clinton at the same time. I remember, I remember watching him and I thought same kind of thing that maybe a little shady, but I thought he was kind of cool. I remember actually really starting to care about it probably a little bit later, but that was probably my introduction too, just him around. And I just always remember Dave Chappelle was like making the thing about him going around and kissing babies. How he'd like pick up the little black baby and kiss it.
that was classic.
Like, it was always, it was funny because that was obviously after the fact, but it was like, that was kind of exactly what was going on there. Like, this guy just kind of seemed like, he didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And he was just, you know, out there doing the deal. So I think Clinton, probably our age and our group here, is probably Clinton was probably the first time that we even knew what was going on there, right?
So, I mean, no. Shout out to you guys for dating yourself. I got in with Barack Obama because that's my youth.
Yeah, and sure. Yeah. Says the oldest guy here.
When I got into it.
Turn off mic four.
No, I'm just kidding. No, I think I agree with you guys. Clinton was a big deal. You know, it was such a time where it was like rebelling from the Reagan-Bush era. And then you had, obviously, politics became such a big thing for, you know, people that were younger. It was like, hey, here's this guy who's not an old, you know, establishment guy that has a talking way about him. But just like Dennis said, he had flaws as well. Yeah. I think Bill Clinton for all of us is probably a big political influence.
I'm actually, I am a little bit younger than you guys. So, yeah, I'll throw that out there. But honestly, it wasn't until probably Bush Gore that I really got into politics.
I remember my parents talking about politics for the first time, like vividly remember Bush Gore.
Yeah.
That's and Ross Perot. My mom was a Ross Perot.
I only remember Ross Perot from a TV show, All That, you know, a kid show on Nickelodeon. And there was someone that would show up with these like giant ears pretending to be Ross Perot that I always thought was very funny. So I was pretty young at that point. And it wasn't really until, let's see, I was probably in 2000 election. I was 12 years old. So I started following then because the recount became a huge deal. Yeah. I didn't really understand what anybody was politically. My family has historically been pretty conservative and votes Republican. So by extension,
they must be so proud of you right now.
Yeah, right. But by extension, I felt like I was a Republican and therefore a George W. Bush supporter just because they were, you know? But I remember really getting into that. And when it came down to the recount, I'm like, oh, well, clearly not everyone agrees with this. Why? And at that point, I started to dive a little deeper, as much as I could at the time, with my 56.
At 12 years old.
With my 56K modem that I had, we had just gotten a computer at that time, America Online, where you had a limit on the number of minutes you could use.
You had to buy the cards.
Yep. Yeah, that's great. So I started researching then, and it all really came to a head. Like 9/11 happened, and after that, I was just neck deep in politics and CNN and everything from that point on. Honestly.
Let me ask you, though, you grew up in a Republican family.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because I think politics go along the lines of religion a lot, right?
Yeah.
You're brought into religion by your family, also brought into politics by your family. Do you remember at what stage or what age you started to kind of break off from that? You were like, wait a minute. Like, was it when we started this podcast 3 months ago?
Yes, 3 months ago is when I decided to start a podcast called Drinking Liberally and just shunned all conservative thought from my mind. No, honestly, it probably wasn't until Barack Obama.
Okay.
Up until that point, that was going into the 2008 election, I considered myself still Republican. And was a huge John McCain fan, honestly. I respect him. I thought that he had some good ideas. If I go back in time, I probably couldn't even tell you what those good ideas were. But I always considered myself a John McCain fan until he picked Sarah Palin as his running mate. And that really turned me on him because I watched interviews with her. And she did great, actually, her first few interviews. Really came off articulate and like she knew what she was doing, but very quickly that spiraled out of control and I realized she probably isn't the best fit for vice president. And in my mind, I was like, well, John McCain's an old man right now.
She'll be president.
If he dies, she's going to be our president. And that thought scared me. I didn't think she had the Katie Couric interview. Remember that? That was the moment. So that turned me, I'm like, well, let's see what else is out there. And then I was like, people talk about this Barack Obama guy. You know, I barely know a thing about him, but people are up on him. Let's see what's up. And, you know, I was kind of sold.
That probably, nice. That moment's when I probably had my first major opinion about politics. I might have even told this before, but I was living in St. Thomas at that time. I remember vividly saying and getting the paperwork that if McCain had become president, I was going to denounce my citizenship.
Wow. And become You're one Dutch. Of those people.
I was going to go to St. Martin, become Dutch. I actually still have the paper. If I can find it somewhere, we can post it on the site.
That'd be great.
I filled it out. I don't want you to post that part.
Wait, is this still possible, or has this time passed?
Yeah, no, I was happy with the Barack thing. But I remember especially being down there in St. Thomas, people would put cars out, like old beat up cars, and spray paint Palin or McCain on it, and it would get like torched and lit on fire there.
What? That's amazing.
Like, it was that big of a deal down there. Like, there was not one person on that island that was for this McCain thing. And again, they're not a formal state by any means, but they're part of this deal. And that was probably my biggest, like, okay, you're right, I'm out of here if this happens, which I probably wouldn't have done, actually. But I was, at that age, I was young, 23, 24. I was ready to go.
So I got this one more story. This is going to totally date me. But I remember Reagan's reelection. I'm in elementary school. Not sure what grade I was in. Now
he was 40 when this happened.
I was.
Way to save face.
There was, I went to a private school. A religious Christian school. I was one of three black kids in my class. And the other two black kids were girls. And one of them I had a huge crush on. And I don't know if you guys did this when you were young, but they had a thing where we had like a mini election in class. They like had the kids, like the students, vote for the president. And
I think I might have done something.
I don't think our school did that.
So honestly, I don't even know who the hell Reagan was running against. Right. But it was like, just, you know, like you were saying, like how your parents indoctrinate you. All I remember was Reagan was like the devil. Like that's all I knew from my house.
Were not good
It was just like, this is a terrible person. Like, no go. So I remember like me, and I know Reagan won and he killed it that year. But the girl that I liked voted for Reagan.
No.
And me and the other like black girl like voted for whoever the other guy was. And I was distraught. I was like, I remember the two of us like kind of cornered her and we were like trying to convince her. I didn't know anything about anything. And I'm just like, what are you doing?
You're throwing out policy ideas.
Yeah.
I love this.
But like, I remember it just shattered me. Oh, this is terrible. But, and the thing is, I remember that. I do not remember a single conversation or hearing my dad or my mom like say anything in my house growing up, but I remember that moment in school, just knowing for some reason that like Reagan was no good, and like this black person voting for Reagan was like, it was crazy, and we had to like fix this.
I would love, we should at some point get somebody on here of an older generation that has gone through Reagan and Nixon, and talk to them about, you know, the comparisons and contrasts of what's going on right now.
Anyone invite their parents?
Yeah.
I wouldn't allow mine on here.
My dad would actually love to come on.
Yeah, bring him.
My mom would start talking about how Ross Perot should have won that election.
And goodness.
We'd be in trouble. Shout out, Mom.
So we talked a little bit. I told the story about how I kind of flipped Republican to Democrat. Does anyone have an issue that you flip-flopped on over your lifetime? Like a big issue?
That you went the other way with?
Yeah.
I do. I've got a couple.
Yeah? Lead us off.
We haven't really talked about this yet. But immigration.
Okay.
Oh, we've talked about it.
Well, I mean,
we've talked about the topic. Yeah.
Yes, we've talked about it endlessly. But no, I used to just be against whatever the Republicans were for when it came to immigration. It's not something I really focused on. But I think in the last couple election cycles, I started paying more attention to it, and I think now that I'm open to changing the legal immigration, like just immigration reform, and Trump is talking about going to like merit based and all that kind of stuff
today.
So I don't know, like I haven't looked into the details of that to say like I'm for that. I definitely wouldn't say I align with the Democratic Party. Really? On immigration anymore. I think there's like, for example, so we know that there's an argument for open borders. And there aren't any Democrats actually arguing and fighting for open borders.
Who's actually?
There's really not an argument.
There's not a political argument, but there's a
humanitarian argument.
Actually, a economic argument for open borders. Like there's
economic benefit to having open borders there are, in certain areas.
There are people that have looked into that and said, if you have open borders, this can actually, you know, be a benefit to the economy and all kind of stuff. But I'm not necessarily advocating for that. But I do think that we need to study more about the economic benefits of our immigration policies and cater the immigration policies to our country's economic benefit. So whether that's we need this many low-wage manual labor workers, we should make sure we get them. if this means we need this many high-skilled technical workers, we should make sure we get them. And I think that should be the priority. And then I'm all for asylum and all those kind of things too. But I do think as a country, we should make sure that, you know, we look around the country, we see like Pete Buttigieg talking about how his town, South Bend, needs more people.
Right.
And I think that like someone should be in charge of that. Someone should be saying, hey, there's different parts and pockets of the country that need, you know, people, and we should be tailoring our immigration policies to say, let's bring people in and let's incentivize them to go to these certain regions and stay there for, you know, like say like, look, you move to this region, you stay here for 5, 6, 8 years, 10 years, whatever it may be that makes it work. And that is going to benefit them because they want to come to the country, and that benefits the cities. Like, I think our policy should be more focused on what the country needs and where we need them in the country and how it benefits the economy.
So you started this by saying that you kind of disagreed with the Democratic stance, but that really sounded like the stance that a lot of Democrats are taking right now as far as immigration goes.
I haven't heard that. I mean, who's...
Yeah.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't heard a cohesive, you know, policy from the Democrats. I remember like we had this deal with the DACA, and mm-hmm. Trump said, well, I want to change how we do the legal immigration. And the Democrats are just like, forget it. We're done. We're not playing that game. Like, we're not touching legal immigration. So like, I just don't see the Democrats willing or open to adjust how we do our regular immigration policies.
I think what you said has a lot of merit. I think that's also a really slippery slope, because a lot of the immigration is to get people out of war-torn countries, and it's a humanitarian effort.
Well,
right?
He did say he accepts asylum seekers.
No, again, I don't think you're against that. I just think that when you said it, it makes a lot of sense. It also kind of, for some reason, it kind of hit me as a little bit of a slippery slope. That's all.
Okay.
We're starting to say, well, you can come here, but only if you go to Iowa and you do this job. I think, you know, the truth is no one has had a good run at this immigration thing in terms of being cohesive and knowing something to fix it. This is why we're at now.
Yeah.
Democrats and Republicans together.
Absolutely.
Yax, how about you? Anything that you've kind of flip-flopped on?
Yeah. So what I flip-flopped on, which is kind of crazy, is, and I'm going to duck when I say this, but when I was in high school, I kind of believed a little bit in like trickle down economics. Well, okay. Because I was sold on the concept that like if a rich guy buys a yacht, right, the amount of money he paid for that is millions of dollars. And then the workers who built that yacht, it trickles down. I actually believed in that in a weird way, that if rich people buy expensive things, it trickles down to the workers that actually built these expensive things, and they're building different places, and you know, we're all going to benefit on that. And I think Reaganomics had a certain charm about it, because when you got into like the 90s, there was this idea about the 80s were so great economically, and, you know, Reagan was this economic hero.
And the 90s boomed.
And it did. But a lot of that, once you got into Clintonomics, which I don't know if there's a term, but let's say it is.
and he had a
great
podcast.
Labor secretary, Robert Reich, who went on to become, you know, who wrote a lot of great books on economics and stuff. That you started realizing that there was this neutral ground of economic growth versus taking care of a middle class and looking out for people that are of lower incomes. And it's not a trickle-down system. It's kind of a fair wage, fair taxation system. Yeah. That is more the trickle-down rather than some rich guy buying a yacht or a mansion somewhere and that like helps everybody out. So, and I fear that the problem with that is I think a lot of conservatives that did believe in that were kind of in this zone of believing in a trickle down and believing in that concept legitimately, right, as an economic theory. Mm-hmm. And as we've gone and on, they've kind of separated that from that and gone more into an extreme where it's a corporate trickle down or it's a corporate economics rather than just a economics of taxation and labor. And that's what's totally been skewered now. Even for conservatives, even those who were true kind of Reaganomics in the 80s, doesn't apply now. That's one thing I flip-flopped on as I got a lot older. I realized, you know what? This is bullshit. We need a real middle class. We need real economic development. That shit doesn't work. And we need to enable our lower income people into being more economically viable in a modern economy rather than the bullshit that Reaganomics was spewing. So I'm glad I learned that lesson.
That's the shame. Like, a lot of these things in theory are amazing, but they just, in practice, I mean, we're seeing it right now, right? Even with this, we're seeing all of these companies, Amazon, the bigger ones that don't pay taxes.
Right.
And it's just unbelievable. I mean, just on the face of it, you're like, what? Like, you're taking over, they're getting a pharmaceutical, not to pick on Amazon, but you're getting into groceries and pharmaceuticals. Yeah, okay. And at the same time, you're not paying taxes on this stuff, but you're growing your business and monopolizing a lot of the market and putting a lot of people out of business without giving back a penny, other than the fact that, you know, if I need diapers tomorrow, they'll be at my door tomorrow morning. And I didn't have that before. I had to get in my car and drive.
Especially now where things aren't American made. Like, that Americans aren't building the products that we're consuming now. It's not a trickle down anymore. It's not like if someone buys something, it's working down to the American worker that built it.
You can't.
So you're right.
You can't expect people that have built a company that big to not do what's best for their business. And that's, I think, what's always been missed. I think it's, you're putting a lot of faith in somebody that, I mean, look at Amazon. This was started out of a garage, right? So, I mean, you're talking about the American dream, this, you know, the hustle, the movement, got it up. You're expecting that at every point to do what's best for that business, continue to grow it. And most of the times that doesn't mean you're getting your products from the United States. So those jobs that you talk about, they're not there. And a lot of that, and it's a shame because you write that out on paper, what you talked about. I was in your same position. I thought, this is great. You know, I mean, I've seen people make great arguments for communism and, you know, it will never work. But if you write it down on a piece of paper and you say, ideally, this is exactly how this should work, you're like, not great, but okay, I can see where you're coming from. In practice, the worst thing of all time.
Yeah. It really gets down to, Yagish, you talked about the middle class. Like, we don't have a middle class anymore in this country. Right. We've effectively eliminated it with these Reaganomic policies.
The gap is wider than it's ever been.
Exactly. The wealth gap is massive. And then if you even break that down further into like a racial wealth gap, it's disgusting to see how stark that contrast is. But like, I think about that all the time because, you know, I grew up in a, you'd call it a middle class family. My parents made middle class money. And I look back at that, I'm like, there's no way I today would live on that same amount of money, adjusted for inflation. Like, no way could I raise three kids the way my parents did,
I thought my dad was rich working on the line at General Motors.
It's 100%.
I'm like, we're.
And a lot of people in
house, we're like, I'm like, oh,
we watched, like, my.
That's the problem in Michigan
father,
now.
Yeah. My father worked on cars most of his life, had an auto body shop, not an auto parts shop that just, you know, fell victim to, you know, the economy, had to shut that down. He used to work on carburetors a lot, and then obviously fuel injection, you know, supplanted carburetors, and that killed that industry, right? And killed the, like, people with those skills. And I just remember watching them be like, no, that's not, like, fair, but it's just kind of how the world works. Like, a new technology always supplants the old one, and we have to figure out ways to adapt to it. Back then, I feel like there was a better opportunity to do so, whereas now we have that same discussion about power. Let's use that. Like, coal is the big one now. How did we adjust coal miners, who are the carburetor people of, you know, the past, and how do we move them to renewable energies or anything else other than coal? And we're really struggling as a society to figure out what those next steps are for those people. And rightfully so, a lot of them are upset. They don't want to take next steps. They're like, well, this is what fed my family for decades. It fed my father's family, fed my grandfather's family.
People just want a job. They want a career. That's, they want a livelihood that's not going to be overtaken by something that's out of their control that they can just feed their families with. And they used to have that in the 70s, 80s, even 90s. And we're at a crossroads now.
We really don't have that anymore, which is a shame. And that's why any politician I see now that is advocating for, you know, tax cuts for the quote-unquote middle class, what's left of it, like, I'm all for that, as long as it's done in an honest way. Like, this previous tax cut was not a tax cut for the middle class, but we've talked about that in depth on other episodes. The key to a strong long-term economy is having that middle class healthy and working livable wages, they can support their families. Everything just works long term if you're supporting those people. Get them educated, get them well paid, and then guess what? You're paying less long term for, you know, even healthcare, because people that are more educated, people that are paid better, tend to be healthier people.
Of course.
So we're not paying, you know, healthcare costs later on, and just
inflation on everything, skyrocketing costs.
And I mean, the scary thing is we're talking about just the coal miners here, right? And right now, really hard, this is affecting a certain portion of our country, right? That is going to grow so exponentially fast to the coasts that we're not prepared for it, because, I mean, you can see it every day. Now you're going through self-checkout lines instead of going to somebody. And, you know, all these people that, like you said, your dad worked on carburetors, right? All these people that did these manual labor jobs, you know, I work in the apartment industry, and I actually went to somewhere where they build like cabinets and all the stuff for the kitchens and stuff. And the guy was telling us, he's like, right now I have 150 workers in here doing this. He's like, the technology we're getting in right now, we can probably run this with 7 within 5 years.
My God.
And we need immediately, as much as with anything else, the environment, anything else, to get so proactive on either education, training to run these robotic things that are taking over, to run this technology.
Yeah. Program
because
them.
Otherwise, you know, these people are going to get phased out.
Mark Cuban talked about this. Yeah. It's very true. Yeah. Technological said, you know, like,
if,
labor. Yeah.
If we don't phase this out, we're going to have to go to a system in our economy where we are giving people a living wage from the government. There's going to have to be
universal basic income,
you know, and that's where everybody gets freaked out about socialism. But if you really look at it right now, again, today, right now, it's affecting a very small portion of our country. People that are doing coal mining, those type of things, and it doesn't hit us day to day. But this is going to spread so fast because we are developing technology. I mean, we're talking about cars that are driving themselves. Taxi drivers are out. Ubers now are going on their own.
Truck drivers are going to be gone.
Absolutely
gone. We won't see another train ever. You know what I mean? A train conductor, like that kind of stuff. Engineers. You see, even in
service industries now, like sales reps are going to be a bygone thing. As Amazon, AI gets better, you don't need a sales rep anymore.
Just opened the store in New York.
Yeah.
They don't even have anybody working at it.
Yeah.
Go to a
McDonald's or Burger King in some places. They used to have a whole huge aisle of people, customer service.
Now it's a kiosk.
Now it's a bunch of kiosks, maybe one person at the front desk.
Yeah.
And this is coming everywhere.
Fast.
Yeah.
Right.
Faster than we're ready for.
We've never been in a position like this in human history where technology has started like a snowball just rolling downhill the way it has been.
And the
you
thing
said
is,
it's exponential. It is.
Yeah.
Like we're just not prepared.
What some of this Make America Great Again stuff and again is people trying to hold on to that past and not in man, if we don't grab onto this future and start figuring out how to move. It's going to get really bad for a lot of people.
It'll
really
leave you behind immediately. But
so one thing, though, that I keep hearing, and I shudder every time I hear it, and I think I've mentioned this to you, Kevin, is retraining.
Yep.
I want Democrats to erase the phrase retraining from their vocabulary. Because do people need to be retrained? Sure, fine, right? But if you put yourself in the shoes of someone who's been a truck driver or a taxi driver or a coal miner or whatever, and their father and their grandfather was and all that kind of stuff, right? And then you say, oh, we're going to retrain you. Now, maybe for us, we live here on the East Coast, like that just sounds like, okay, well, I got to switch careers or I got to learn something different and learn a skill.
Right. It's every year for
it's
us.
It's different in Madison, Wisconsin.
Right. You put yourself in their shoes and you hear retraining and it's like a personal attack. It's like I'm invalidating everything you are, your family was, what you've been doing for the last three generations, garbage.
Yeah.
Like we're going to make you something else. And people are just like, that's just not something that people are going to take kindly to.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Michigan. Our entire economy and everything in that state is buoyed by the
automotive.
We're the auto industry, period. We saw when the collapse happened. I mean, there were talks of Michigan seceding into Canada. Like it was, and it was tongue in cheek, but not so much. Those bailouts don't happen. I mean, Michigan's on the rebound now, but it's scary stuff when you see it go down that way.
Yeah, I just think what we need to talk about is industry and, you know, the new economy and those kind of things. And forget talking about we're going to train you to do this. Let's just say, you know what? Here's this community. You guys don't have a lot of jobs. The companies are leaving left and right. We're going to provide incentives and we're going to bring in this new whatever it is, factory or this new company that we're going to incentivize to move into this area. And let's just talk about that, because if that company moves in or those companies move in and they've got signs saying, hey, we need workers, no one's going to sit there and say, well, I don't want that job. If the job's there, people are coming to get them.
It's not always the case, though. I think you've seen it in Michigan. Somebody like the owner of the Cavs, Dan Gilbert, has tried to move a lot of the financial, his financial stuff into Detroit, try to re-get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I see all the time job postings there. And I have friends there without work. And, you know, a lot of people, like we just said, my dad was in the auto industry. I'm in the auto industry. This is what I'm doing. And I think it's a harder thing than just saying, go get this other job, which I think you guys are making that point. At some point, living wage is going to have to be discussed. It just is.
I think that's eventually where we end up. Yeah. Like, if we end up in a, you know, Star Trek future, like, there's no other choice. Like, that's the inevitable conclusion. Because if technology is going to keep advancing to the point where we don't have jobs anymore, and AI gets to the point where you even take those service industry jobs that you thought a human could always do and would always do forever, there's no choice but to start just paying people. And we've seen it play out in some Norwegian countries, Scandinavian countries, I should say, pretty successfully. And I know here, you know, they would label that socialism immediately and it'd be, you know, thrown under the rug. But that's where it's going to have to go if you want people to survive. Yeah. And frankly, part of that excites me. Maybe we see that at the end of my lifetime. I don't know what time frame is on that, if we don't kill the planet in the meantime. But the idea to me that everyone be free to do what you want to do, because you don't have to worry about paying your bills or worrying about your healthcare or something like that, and you're free to do whatever your talent is. Say, like, Yax, you're interested in music, and Dennis, you're a great painter, and, like, what do you want to do, Jeff?
Bartend, I don't know.
You want to bartend. Cool. But, like, but you're free to explore that to its fullest potential without worrying about how do I pay my bills this week.
Right.
And we will see in that version of the world, like, such an explosion of arts and culture. Think of how many people are probably super talented. Singers, artists, whatever you want to be, actors, that just never get a shot because they didn't grow up in the right kind of family. They didn't grow up in the right zip code. They didn't make the right amount of money and never got into those classes to learn at a young age.
Well, one thing that I'll say, and Jeff brought it up, is this idea about trying to cling on to the old days, is Obama and Hillary saw this. And they were now, granted, it weren't like policies, plans, all that. Obama was at the end of his term. Hillary talked about all those renewable energy jobs in Pennsylvania.
Hillary did have plans for that. But it was the retraining that Dennis talked about.
And the thing is, these are the people that at least saw the issue. Right? Like, Grant, maybe they didn't have a policy in place. Maybe they didn't have a plan. Their time
Again,
went around.
Hillary had a plan.
Yeah, Hillary had a plan for renewable energy. That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, right now, people are even not, everything we're talking about right now isn't considered a problem. It's not even in the windshield wiper of what's in the future. It's all like, well, let's go back to the good old days, like Jeff was talking about. And I think that is the bigger problem right now. We all have good ideas right now and things we're talking about and this and that. But what's going on right now is this isn't even something that's considered urgent to the people running the country.
I think the short to midway fix on this is investing in infrastructure. Because I think if we take these people that are skilled laborers and doing this stuff and we're not trying to retrain them per se, but we're saying, hey, you're building cars. Now we need to build some bridges. We need to rebuild buildings. We need to green fit these buildings that aren't going to survive if the climate starts to change. I think that is, as opposed to having everybody go out there and learn how to operate robots.
Well, I agree with that.
I think infrastructure is our next step. It's not the solution by any means. We have to have a forward-thinking plan.
Yeah, once you finish your infrastructure, what's
next? Buttigieg has a lot of time. What's the what are we going to look like when he's Donald Trump's age?
Right.
And 34 or whatever.
I agree with that for that kind of worker. But what about the worker that's used to going to an office every day to a 9-to-5 doing a regular job that's in around the country? Like, these are jobs that are now completely being phased out of our economy.
Well, I think that's another thing. There's going to be desk jobs 9-to-5 around that. I think if we have a big infrastructure plan to fix crumbling roads, bridges, buildings, I think a lot of that can be moved to that without asking somebody to learn Arabic in a year and then learn how to speak it fluently to survive. I think if we're asking you to go from whatever, being an accountant at a bookkeeping place that books aren't going to be around anymore, and now you have to do it, you know, for a construction company, I don't think that's the bigger jump than having to teach somebody to learn how to run a robot that's building a Mercedes. I think that's probably the short term.
We saw that in the New Deal. Yeah, we saw that in the New Deal.
That's in the New Deal.
A huge part of it.
It's a big part of it.
Investing in infrastructure. We had the highway projects that built all the interstates across America. Massive undertaking to do this. And honestly, America was pretty late to the game.
No, very late.
When it came to creating the infrastructure to connect our coasts to each other. That will employ a massive amount of people while we figure the rest of this shit out. You're right, Jeff.
And it buys us
time.
It doesn't buy us a long time.
No.
And one last thing I want to say before we get off economics and all this stuff is one other thing that we should all really be keeping an eye on is the concept of monopolies. And that's becoming a way bigger issue than even I ever thought.
You saw Disney just bought Hulu?
And the way it's happening in multimedia.
Yep.
It's happening on the internet. You got Facebook.
Wait. But now I can watch the X-Men fight the Marvel Cinematic Universe characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can finally get the Wolverine Deadpool movie. So
right.
I'm good with it.
Come on, Jeff. That was already in the same universe.
He wasn't allowed on there.
We can get Deadpool versus like Iron Man coming up.
Oh, yeah. All that stuff. We're going to be ruled by three companies anyway. Disney, Amazon, and Facebook, Google can kind of split the rest. And it's all fair. There we go.
Was right. And that's a Pixar, Disney thing, and they predict it. By and large or something like that? It's just one company that owns everything.
Before we get too far away, me and you didn't answer the, you know, kind of where we've ever jumped sides.
Oh, right. I thought I got to dodge that.
I talked about Dave Chappelle earlier, and I remember, you know, I get a lot of my stuff, obviously, like it's pop culture and comedy. And I remember Chris Rock's one of his earlier comedies, he was talking about the difference between Republicans and Democrats. And he was talking about everybody wanting to be down with a gang. And he said, you know, why don't you take the information, let it swirl around your head a little bit, and then form an opinion. And that always kind of stuck with me. And I was sitting here trying to think what we were talking about when I've really gone away from the Democrat thing. And I don't know that I really have, only because I've always thought about wanting to be on the right side of history. And I've always thought when it came to women's rights and, you know, any class of society that's been minimalized or put to the side or not given the same rights as everybody else, I've always really thought that I've wanted to be on the right side of history with those thoughts. And I really think, and not to be a shill for the Democrats, because we've screwed a lot of stuff up, but I really feel like for the majority of my life when I've cared about politics, we've kind of been on the right side of history. Like, we've done the right thing to minimalize people. And not always in practice, but mostly in theory. Mostly we've passed the rights for, you know, men to get married to men. And, you know, we've been on the right side of the abortion conversations. And because of that, and there's some policies and other stuff, obviously, that I've not always completely agreed with. Doesn't mean I've necessarily agree with what the Republicans said about it, but I felt this party, for the most part, again, you can send me 600 reasons why they're not, I thought for the most part that I've been on the right side of history by voting Democrat. I don't know that I've really ever swayed heavily on anything. I'm sure if I really dug down, I'd be like, yeah, that's a dumb policy and the Republicans had it right. But I think me personally, I've just felt like we've been kind of been progressive. We've kind of been to rights for everybody for the most part and tried to get there. We have a long fucking way to go. I'm not sitting here trumpeting our horn by any means. And, you know, some of our candidates that are running right now are scaring the shit out of me about this. because we do have some, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Pete, that I think I'm like, wow, they're really pushing to be out in front of this stuff.
Really putting them in the same sentence right now, huh?
Yeah. I have to group them together a little bit.
We'll argue about that on a later pod.
Elizabeth's
right now
really climbing the charts for me. fiance.
Good. She should be. She should be climbing everybody's charts right now if you consider yourself progressive.
Are you the only one that's come here from a Republican family?
That's a good question. You guys tell me.
Mine is.
I know I didn't.
My dad is staunch. He's a Trump supporter.
Yogs?
No, my parents were both Democrat.
Oh, wow.
Immigrants came in. I was actually, like I said, in high school, I liked Reaganomics. I liked other things. I got in an argument with an older family friend one time. It was infamous when I was defending like Reaganomics or something stupid like that. So like my parents were like, are you our kid? So,
so you were the Michael J. Fox.
I was. And it was funny because that was one of my favorite shows at the time. I was like, yeah, I am.
I grew up driving with my dad in the car listening to Rush Limbaugh. Like, I remember this.
I'm so sorry.
Like, I listened. That was the one radio. Him and Jim Rome, right? That's what I remember from my childhood. My dad, those were the two people I heard on the radio. And my dad is a Trump supporter. He's Republican. I don't remember him being that way when I was younger, staunchly, but now he is. My mom's liberal, I guess. But I, for whatever reason, like, I never bought into that stuff. I heard a lot of it. And I just thought it was fucked up. How about you?
All right. I'll say, which I'm going to be extremely embarrassed and ashamed about to admit, probably LGBTQ rights. Growing up, I honestly didn't encounter many gay people or queer people. Man, I hope I don't get crucified for this.
It's not a bad take. And I'll be honest. Here's the thing, which I think you're trying to get at.
Well, tell me after I have my take here.
No, I get it. But no, that part, not the take. I mean, the part of the take you're talking about, embarrassed. There's a lot of people don't grow up around people of that orientation, and it's just something of not being used to it, and that's the shame they feel in that.
Well, like, I didn't know any gay people, and then it wasn't until, like, high school I started, like, oh, yeah, gay people exist. Like, this isn't just something you hear about. And meeting gay people and then reading about life experiences for people that are very different than mine, like, kind of opened my eyes to the fact that I live in this little bubble where everything's fine for me as a straight white dude, and it's very much not fine for people outside of that bubble. And it took probably too long in my life to come to that realization, and I wish I had always felt that.
Yeah, but a lot of
what
has
I
to
do now,
with,
but it's
where you're from, right?
It was just something that took a long time. Like, I remember, though, when Massachusetts legalized gay marriage, right? I do remember being around people that were like, oh, that's so weird. Massachusetts is fucked up. What's going on over there? Like, I thought that was just a San Francisco thing. And at that point, I was like, oh, this is kind of, I guess, today I would call it toxic. I don't know what I would have called it back then. But I remember, like, being a little weirded out by those responses at the time. Be like, what do you care? Then the more I read, and the internet, again, to its credit, one of the few good things the internet can do is let you see other people's opinions and other life experiences from their eyes. And as I read more and more about that, and you see just, like, what they have to go through, it really changed me, like, it did a 180 on that. Like, I don't understand now how anyone feels differently because we're so connected. And when you see, like, a hate crime committed against an LGBTQ person now, like, if that doesn't turn your stomach and make you wonder, like, what the fuck is wrong with America, then I don't know what's going to do it. Like, that's something that, again, kind of embarrassed that I felt that way before.
We shouldn't be that happy. That's the story of anyone from, like, middle America that moves to a big city. Like, someone that, like, I've heard this story so many times when I was working in the city. And I, even from being from, like, New Jersey, or that you're from Long Island, mm-hmm. which is not far from New York, but right. It's still, like, there's still different mindsets.
Long Island is very red compared to New York.
Exactly. And I had people that I knew from the Midwest that moved to New York and said they'd never met a gay person in their life until they got to the city. You do feel that, like, oh, I'm ashamed that I never thought this from the get-go, but how much of this stuff is environment? And I feel like that is very true right now with America. It's environment. It's people are growing up in communities and areas where they're not with people.
So how do we fix that?
Your story right there is how it's fixed, right? Because getting those stories out there and talking to people, it's talking to people. It's like he said, learning from people that move from it, get to see it and change their mind, and they have to get their voices out there to be like, you know, go back to your communities and be like, guys, this is fucked up. Like, this is not the way we think it is. It's much different. Here's what's really happening. it's all communication. And unfortunately, right now, we're in a point where, you know, the communication is the worst part that we have going, right? Because it's all just being fed to us so quick, and you can get in such a bubble that it's almost worse now than just leaning on what you thought from your parents in your town. Because if you want to just hear those things, now you can hear them from people in California and Texas and Florida. You know, you can get kind of backup for your feelings and get even more staunchly in that position.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas, you know,
that's the negative aspect of social media and the internet.
Yeah.
100%.
And I mean, it's going from the Midwest to the coastal, right? And I think that's why a lot of people from the Midwest feel misrepresented. They don't get to come out and see this. Like, I moved from Michigan. I didn't see what I see in New York and New Jersey. I dated a woman in Michigan that was African American. There it was very like, we would go into the mall and we would get looks, and it was a big deal. When I moved out to Jersey, she came out, we'd walk into New York City, no one batted an eye.
Yeah, I bet.
That we were holding hands. You know what I mean? But it wasn't that way at 18 years old in Michigan. And I just think it's that. It's you're telling
getting
that story.
Out of your bubble.
I think it's the communication. I think it's talking about it and letting people know that these are people that might live next door to you, man. This isn't some weird class of people that you don't interact with. These are everybody around.
You know what? And I'm just spitballing here. I would love to see high schools do more like exchange programs. Within the United States, send city kids to rural areas, rural kids to city areas, and just like explore a culture within our own country that's different from your own.
Cut this. What a reality
and
show. Timestamp.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Wait, we probably, yeah.
We just, that's a
we don't
want to
give up that idea. Yeah.
That's on Fox on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m.
I just think about how much I probably would have benefited as a high school kid when like you're in those like formative years to just experience something way outside your comfort zone and just see how other people live. And hopefully at the end of it, you have a greater insight to how other people feel and a little more empathy, because we really
especially
lack
with
that
races.
Right now.
But you talked about going to school with three black kids in your school, right?
Yeah, but before we go there, like I don't know, I'm not necessarily trying to challenge you guys on this.
Yeah, do it.
Please do.
But I have a question, because one, I think I totally get what you're saying, Kevin, and I like respect it. But I remember. I don't think you should apologize for your feelings about LG. I always screw that up.
LGBTQ.
Oh, I haven't said it so far.
Yeah. So it's drinking liberally. I've been drinking a little bit. I'm sorry. I can't get the.
If you grow from the what you thought before, that's how you progress
yeah.
as a person.
And like so,
you can have some shitty feelings before.
Yeah. I look. When I was a kid, I've said a lot of terrible things, and that's one of the one things I regret most growing up in junior high school and high school is the comments I made about gay people to other people. And I look back now and I'm like, wow, I'm shudder at it. It's like crazy. How did I think like that? So it's a growth, like you're growing. Like you become an adult, you get older, you like realize the stuff you're doing when you were a kid was stupid. But like one thing I will say is that once I was aware of it and I kind of looked back, there were definitely gay people that I went to school with.
Oh, yeah.
Going back to like.
And you see it now, right?
You're right. Like, now yeah. I see it. Right. But like back then you just, you know, it was just a slur and like, oh, that person's weird. They act different. So we're going to just like throw these like slurs at them or whatever. But then, you know, you grow up and then you realize like, oh, that's what that was. Like for the people in the Midwest, gay people are everywhere. Like it's not like all the gay people are in New York and California.
Right, right.
They're in Detroit and they're in Wisconsin. They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's just like culturally, it may not be acceptable or safe for them to be out, but they're there. They are your neighbors. I still think you like your idea about the exchange thing in high schools. I think that's a great idea. I think people need to be exposed to different cultures.
The lack of education about what's really out there, it doesn't arm kids with knowledge about these things. It's like you're not sitting there talking about when a man's with a man or a woman's with a woman. It's just not, so it's not normalized at that age. And if you grow up in a household where, you know, and we all have grandparents, right? Life was a lot different in the 60s. And you always going to hear your grandparents.
60s.
Or 50s, you know what I mean? But you're going to hear your grandparents say some things. And a lot of times you just got to be like, that's grandpa. It has to start from a younger age. And the problem is when you have certain parts of the country, that's never going to be allowed at the age it needs to be allowed. It needs to be talked about. It needs to be normalized early, or else you get people that just grow up with these feelings about this taught from generations. Mm. And it's not their fault. And it takes sometimes people getting out there and realizing on their own, like, hey, this is fucked up. But some people, like Dennis, you just said, you made those. There's people that stay in that bubble of where they're at, and they never get that realization that this was fucked up. That's just what it is. They still think that those slurs are okay and the way they treated people are okay. Mm. And it doesn't, if you learn that it's not okay, it doesn't forgive what you did, but it does allow you to be a better person going forward and do the right thing the next time.
The point you made about how there's gay people everywhere, the thing that's crazy is if you think about the times that we're talking about, it was, you were not allowed to be open if you were in one of these communities in the Midwest or the South or anywhere like that. And you
I'd
had
say
to,
even here in New York.
Being I open is a people, long time.
Being I think open back, in middle yeah. school or high school right now right. sounds like the worst yeah. thing in history to
absolutely.
Be. Even if you're in San Francisco or Atlanta yeah. or New York City,
well,
I still can't think that's yeah. a great yeah. experience.
And that's the time we come from. I'd like to think it's changing for the better now. And I see it a little bit. You see a lot more people that are in these areas that are able to be more open and be who they are. And it's a shame that it took in our era for people to have to move to a big city to be able to meet a first openly gay person. And that's wild. I hope now at least it's gotten a little bit better. But, and that's the one thing we should all take into account, that it's about like changing times. But if you look at the way it is now, it's getting better. But I worry now that we're in a time where things are going backwards. We're going backwards as far as like reproductive rights. We're going backwards as far as like civil rights. We're going backwards with so many types of rights that I'm afraid we're falling back into that era we grew up in, where no one could speak out about being openly gay or openly anything they wanted to be. And that's
make America great again.
Yeah,
man.
It's scary.
So what we have to do, and we're gonna wrap this up,
I think we learned a little bit about each other here.
Yeah.
And hopefully the audience learned a little bit about us as they
and hopefully don't us. Hate us now.
No, I mean, listen, honest conversation's big, and if we all want to sit here and come from a point that we've always been perfect advocates of everything that's happening, we're not giving an honest conversation to the people that are listening to us. And I think that's unfair.
Honestly, moving forward, for anybody that's been in situations like us where maybe you have disagreements with people politically in your life, whether it's family or friends, it's a tough conversation to have. It really is. If you care about that person and you don't want to upset them, you're worried they might get upset with you for having a different opinion, I totally get that. That's really where you have to start, though. I've tried to make a conscious effort to have discussions with my own family members that I never would have brought up in the past because I was afraid of it starting a fight.
Well, do you remember the big thing was stay away from politics at Thanksgiving,
right, yeah. Yeah, you never talk religion Easter. Or politics.
Well,
like, those are
the
big topics.
Now's the time to speak about it.
And
ruin some
there's
dinners.
A way, and I don't think you even need to ruin dinners. You can talk about it in a way that hopefully if they respect you as a person, they will understand why you are coming from the viewpoint that you are. You're not going to agree on everything. Like, just accept that to start. It's impossible, and you're not going to change everybody's minds. But bringing up topics about, say, I've had discussions with family members about the family separation policy. We don't agree on a lot of other politics, but we agreed that separating children from their families, whether you're an illegal immigrant or not, is just cruel.
And that's a great starting point, right?
And you can grow from that, and you can just say, let's look at this from a humanitarian standpoint. We're all human beings. We all understand or can fathom what it would be like to have your kid taken away from you, or a family member that you love taken away from you. Like,
someone.
Everybody can understand that pain. And you can start from there and just build on that discussion going forward. So there are these conversations you can have. I know it's very tough, but I'd recommend everyone just sit down with someone that disagrees with you and try to at least approach one of these topics going
and
forward.
And at the same time, try to understand them too. Like,
yeah,
understand where they're coming from. I think a lot of times it's all become so argumentative based that more conversations need to happen.
Communication, like you said.
So we're going to wrap that up then. and close out our after hours round table. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure sitting here and just talking about
cheers, gentlemen.
Whatever comes up on our minds.
Cheers.
Give us feedback out there if you enjoyed this. We plan to do more.
Yeah, and there are topics you want us to talk about. We're looking to get into some other just broader topic-based discussions and in addition to our normal weekly day-by-day what's-going-on type episodes.
Some more policy-specific.
Yeah. If you have any ideas on what we could talk about on a future after-hours roundtable, hit us up on social media. You can do so on Twitter and Instagram at @drinking_libpod. Or check out our website. There's a contact us page there. You can send us an email, www.drinkingliberallypod.com. Thanks for joining us this week, everyone. Cheers.